So I'm Anne Doig. I live in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, and I lead tours all around Scotland. And each area of Scotland has got very strong local traditions and dialects. Up in the northeast, it's called the Doric. And my grandfather spoke the Doric and standard English. You would not understand somebody with Doric speaking to you. And one example is this, and it goes, fit, fit, fits, fit, fit. Fit in the Doric is what? And fit also means foot. And so it's which or what foot fits what or which foot, meaning your boot. Fit, fit, fits, fit, fit.
Scotland is a little country that packs a big punch, and a proud identity unites its sparse but feisty population. Kilts, bagpipes, whiskey, caber tossing, haggis, poetry, all of these compete for Scotland's top icon. But what do these icons mean to the Scots today? And how do we understand Scotland today beyond the stereotypes? I'm joined by two guides right now from Scotland, Liz Lister and Helen Houston, who I'm sure are both clad in plaid right now, prepared to talk about Scottish identity today. Liz, Helen, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you very much.
Probably not clad in plaid, but that rhymed and I wanted to say it. But I think metaphorically you're clad in plaid because yeah, like, you both celebrate your Scottish identity in such a beautiful way.
It's like Liz Lister, tongue twister.
Liz Lister, tongue twister. That's interesting. Yeah, that is a tongue twister in itself. Do Scottish is there a Scottish term for tongue twister, or do you say tongue twister?
I think we just say tongue twister,
tongue
yes.
Tongue twister. If Robbie Burns was going to share a tongue twister, what do you think it would be?
Many a mickle, Max a muckle. That's it. Many a mickle, Max a muckle. Which
what
means
is that?
Look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. All the little bits add up to something big.
There you go. I had a hunch there might be a Robbie Burns tongue twister with a little dose of wisdom. There's so much wisdom that comes out of Scottish folk culture. So Liz, tell me about how you sort out your national loyalty. I just love working with you and you help me research my Scotland guidebook and so on. Do you consider yourself Scottish or British, or how do you sort that out?
Well, I think in Scotland, a significant proportion, up at some polls at 80%, of Scots see themselves as Scottish first and British second. And then, you know, what tends to be classed overseas as English is horrific to Scots. About 2% would see themselves as English or European even. They don't see themselves as European. Now, that's not to say that we're all fierce, passionate, independent-seeking Scots, but it is a very, very strong cultural identity of being Scottish. We recognise ourselves as being different from the rest of the UK in a proud way, in a positive way.
Sure. And I mean, people should remember English and British are two different things also, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. But some people can forget that overseas.
Yeah. So remember, British is much broader. I mean, a Welsh person and a Scottish person and an English person.
And Northern
generally
Ireland.
British and Northern Ireland as well. Hey, Helen, if I was to ask you, where are you from? What would you say? Britain or Scotland?
Definitely from Scotland.
So just
like Liz, I'm Scottish first and British second.
Yeah. And within Scotland, you've got regional variations as well. Liz, how would you divide Scotland as far as cultural regions?
Well, I think that the thing that most differentiates the regions is the dialect. So language is a very strong means of identifying culture and identity. And so across Scotland, we have a range. If you come to Glasgow, as some people probably have, you know, they can find the Glaswegian accent a bit challenging when they're chatting with Ouijis. They may go up to Aberdeen. Fit like means how are you? So very strong Doric language up in Aberdeen in the northeast. Yeah. But then, of course, you also have the two languages of Scotland, because traditionally the Highlands would have spoken Gaelic. And so nowadays, after a significant decline in Gaelic, we're finding that there's a resurgence. We have Gaelic schools where the medium of education is Gaelic. It's not just that it's a language that's taught. The whole curriculum is taught in Gaelic. So Gaelic is particularly up in the Western Isles and the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, real resurgence of Gaelic, which perhaps is not the case down in the Lowlands, where they would have traditionally spoken Old Scots or Lallans. And that was really frowned upon because down in the lowlands of Scotland, that was seen as Northern Britain. And so it was not fashionable to be speaking Lowland Scots. You had elocution lessons to make sure that you spoke as a Northern Britisher, not as a Scot.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. The language is really a driving force there that identifies the regions, it sounds like. And of course, you got the big cities, you got Edinburgh, and then I like how you can refer to the people from Glasgow as not Glaswegians, but Ouijis, right?
Yeah.
And then, but Highland, I think a lot of our romantic ideas of Scotland come from the Highland culture up in the north. But there's a lot of population south of Edinburgh. Is that called the Borders or the Lowlands or what?
Well, the Borders are south of Edinburgh, but the main population in Scotland is in what we call the Central Belt, which is if you draw a line between Glasgow and Edinburgh and take about 30 miles north and about 20 miles south, that 50-mile band, that's where the majority of the population is. And that's where, you know, the Scots would be speaking Old Scots. If you think of Rabbi Burns' poetry, that is mostly written in Old Scots. That's the Central Belt.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're taking a closer look at Scottish identity right now with our guides Helen Houston and Liz Lister. Liz and Helen have been guiding in Scotland for many years. During the pandemic, when tourism came to a halt, they took their Blethers, or chats, to an audience, and the Scottish Blethers podcast was born. You can learn more about that anywhere you get your podcasts. Just look for Scottish Blethers, Blethers. Helen, you know, when I travel to Ireland, I'm so aware of the famous Irish diaspora. You know, with the famine and hard times, so many Irish people left. And today, I believe there's 30 million Americans with Irish heritage. What about Scotland? And what about tough times in Scotland's past? Did that result in a kind of diaspora for the Scottish people?
Yes, very much so, very much so. One of the first ones would be around about the mid-1700s. After what some of our listeners will know of the Jacobite uprisings, when the Battle of Culloden changed life in Scotland completely, got rid of the clan system, and many people were either forced out, just as they were in Ireland during the famine, or went voluntarily over to Canada, America at that time. And then again, it's not so well known, but Scotland did suffer a famine about the same time, the same potato blight was in Scotland as in Ireland. And so many Scots were starving, but not to the extent they were in Ireland because they weren't so totally dependent on the potato. There were other things. And many of the landowners were quite helpful to them. And then later on, they went out to Canada. There was free passages almost to Canada and land grabs given out.
You know, Liz, what Helen was just saying reminded me of, I think I was on the Isle of Skye, and I learned that there were landowners, absentee landowners, that found it a little more profitable and a little less headaches to have sheep instead of human beings on their property. And they figured out ways of getting rid of the people so they could just have the animals.
Yeah, that was the days of the great white sheep, which had been really successful down in the Borders, a breed of sheep, big white meaty sheep. And to be able to feed it up and make the profit that the new landowners were looking for, they had to move the people from the best land. So they moved them to the coast and they put them working in industries like kelp farming, where they were standing waist deep in freezing water, gathering baskets of kelp, which the landowners then sold at great profit because the time of Napoleonic Wars, there was no potash. And so they needed alkaline material for glass and soap making. And then, of course, when the war ended, they didn't need that. And so the people were homeless. They had no industry. And so that's when you started to see people going voluntarily and then forcibly. But you mentioned there about icons at the beginning of the, you've reamed off a whole load of Scottish stereotypes, the haggis and the caber and all of the rest of it. One of our icons is the thistle. And I always think of it as reflecting the diaspora of Scotland, because if you think of a thistle head, when you blow it, the seeds go carried away on the wind. And that's exactly what happened to the Scots all over the world.
Perfect. What a great metaphor. And when I was thinking of those icons and I was hearing of how Helen described this hard and sad history, I wondered, do you think one reason Scotland embraces the icons of its culture so much is it has to cling to something when when it's an uphill battle just to survive as a culture. When you think of the hard times when you couldn't even play the bagpipes and you couldn't even wear a kilt after a certain war when the English wanted to keep down the indigenous Scottish people. Does that contribute to the fury with which the Scottish people hang on to their icons?
I think there's very mixed feelings about that, because a lot of people think that we should be moving forward, and they get annoyed when you see places like Loch Ness and Drumnadrochit with all the tourist hat, the tartan and the kilts, yep, and the, you know, the towels, yep, in the form of kilts and all of that. But when they do surveys across the world, they find that those stereotypes don't do us any harm, but they have to be seen in the context of a modern Scotland. So some of our stereotypes, our icons, like our landscape, our mountains, our scenery, our warmth of our people, they are positive and should be continued, but in a modern context.
That's the challenge, I think, is to have them continue respecting the traditions and still in a modern context. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Helen Houston and Liz Lister. They're our guides today as we learn more about Scottish identity and Scottish icons. If you'd like to hear more from Liz and Helen, they've got a wonderful podcast. It's called Scottish Blethers, Bletheres. So, Helen and Liz, let's talk for a minute about these stereotypes. What would you, as tour guides, like travelers to understand when they come to Scotland about these things? I'm just going to say the icon and you can share it. Liz, tell us about kilts and tartan.
Well, obviously, a large part of Scottish heritage and still going strong today. Anyone can have their own tartan. Shrek's got a tartan. Corporations have got tartans. All you need to do is get your own tartan designed and have it registered with the Registry of Tartans, and off you go. So very much a thing of the past, when it was all down to the dyes in the local area, put into the wool and made the colours of the tartan, which took on regional patterns right up to Queen Victoria. And tartanry, which was all about the resurgence of Scotland after it had gone through a period of decline that we talked about.
And there was a time in the Romantic age, the Victorian age, when British royalty was kind of charmed by the Scottish culture and chose to have Balmoral Castle, and there was a sort of a resurgence of traditional Scottish icons. Helen, can you talk a little bit about that Romantic resurgence of Scotland from a British point of view?
Yes, it was Queen Victoria who really fell in love with Scotland, and she bought Balmoral, as you say, and it was really with Victoria and Albert that tartan came back into the fore. And of course, Sir Walter Scott was very much Victoria's idol as well, and he, through his romantic novels, painted this picture of Scotland. And he invited, in 1822, George IV to come up to Scotland. Now, that was the first time a British monarch had come up to Scotland since all the troubles in the early 1700s. And Sir Walter Scott persuaded George IV to wear tartan, to clad himself from top to toe in tartan, in a kilt, a jacket and everything. George IV didn't quite like his legs under a kilt, so he's reputed to have worn pink stockings under his kilt, which caused quite a stir.
It's quite striking to think of a British royal wearing tartan.
Yes. Well, when they're up in Scotland, they tend to wear tartan. But even, you know, ordinary people wear tartan nowadays. If you go to a Scottish wedding where both the bride and groom are from Scotland, you'll probably find about 75 to 80% of the men are all wearing kilts, tartan outfits. And most men will have their own kilts, because that's what they do. My son got his kilt out for his 21st birthday, for example. That was a kind of a traditional thing to do.
And Liz, when you see King Charles wearing a kilt, how does the Scottish person react to that? What do you see when the king is wearing a kilt?
That's it. He is at home in it. He's comfortable in wearing it. It's interesting that William has said he'll never wear a kilt. That's good. You know, it's individual choice. It doesn't mean that he's any less pro-Scottish. But actually, if you go to any high street today, where all the tourist shops are, you'll see that competing with the tartan nowadays, we have Harris Tweed. And it's interesting because you were talking there about the landowners and the harsh conditions that some of them implemented on their land. But many of them tried to introduce industry to give food and money to the tenants. And one of those was the Countess of Dunmore. And she realised that the people on the Western Isles, on Harris particularly, were producing this warm woolen material called tweed. and she took it down to London, to fashionable London, and before you knew it, there was an industry in Harris Tweed, and that's still going strong today with the Orb. Just like cheddar cheese and French champagne, it can't be called Harris Tweed unless it's made on the island of Harris.
On the island of Harris. And I think I remember being, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I was on the north end of Skye looking out, and somebody said, that's Harris, the island of Harris. I thought, Harris Tweed.
Yes, right you have there. To visit magnificent islands.
Yeah. Liz, can you, as a bletherer or a tour guide, give us a little context of the Highland Games? To me, it's such a beautiful celebration of Scottish culture.
Well, you've attended your own Highland Games with me, Rick, and you entered
That's
into
right.
a number of races. You've tried to lift the stone, yeah? And it's a festival of strength, feats of strength, piping, Highland dancing, speed. In the old days, it was started by Malcolm III, who was trying to find out the fleetest foot messenger and the strongest man to have in his band of servants.
I was wondering about that. I thought there must be a warrior, old-fashioned military kind of excuse for these games.
Yeah, but one of the best things is that they're usually situated in beautiful locations where you have hill races and other sports. So, you know, it's a real festival.
Yeah, I'll never forget with you. I didn't want to go to the big famous ones that are on TV. I wanted a small town clan gathering. And you knew just the right one when we were visiting with our TV crew. And we were able to have a beautiful day filming that. And I'll never forget the guys taking off on their fell running. And they were gone. And then quite a long time later, they'd come back in having run all over the hills. This has been so much fun talking to both of you about Scotland. I want to remind people that you've really enjoyed this podcast, and it was sort of born out of the time when we couldn't travel, and you thought you would share it with your travelers as a regular podcast, Scottish Blethers, Bletheres. And I know one of the topics that is reoccurring is the word of the week on your podcast. Can we finish our conversation like you finish your blethers with a word of the week? What would you guys like to share?
Well, having been involved in all of this, I would say that I'm fair puggled. I'm tired out.
Pubbled.
Puggled. P-U-G-G-L-E-D. Fair puggled. Very
puggled.
Tired. Yes.
Well, you just anti-puggled me. You energized me. And Helen, what's your word of the week?
Well, I would say that we've had very, very dreich weather the past few weeks.
Dreich. What is dreich?
D-R-E-I-C-H. Dreich means just dull, rainy, miserable, dreich. A fabulous word that just describes it.
Oh.
Much better than dull, just dreich.
Well, Helen Houston and Liz Lister, you bring sunshine to me when we can talk about Scotland. So best wishes in your dreich weather and best wishes with your continued blethers. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Helen Houston tells us what it's like to visit the island of St. Kilda, whose only full-time inhabitants are sheep. It's in a short extra from today's interview. You can hear it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our celebration of Scottish culture continues as we visit with singer Jim Malcolm and hear what poet Robbie Burns means to his fellow Scots. Hi, it's Travel with Rick Steves.